From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we're the Buffalo Roam again. We talk with Rebecca Adamson about the projects her organization funds to help Native Americans gain economic self-sufficiency, like the project which brought back the buffalo to the Lakota people. She just received one of Ms. Magazine's Women of the Year awards. Also, 18 films to watch and no leaving during a film to go to the bathroom. We talk with John Powers about the good and bad parts of being a juror at the Sundance Film Festival. The festival awards were given out Sunday. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Independent People, the novel by Icelandic author Haldur Laxness, which was first published in 1946 and has been out of print until now. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Congressional Budget Office projects that the federal deficit will be smaller than expected over the next 5 years. The new numbers will make it easier for the President and Congress to balance the budget. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Congressional Budget Office Director June O'Neill told the Senate Budget Committee today that deficits now look about a third smaller than they did a year ago. Although the news is good, O'Neill's office was criticized for estimates last year that proved too high. The new forecast moves closer to the deficit estimates made by the White House, which will make it easier for those involved in the budget process to reconcile their numbers. O'Neill says to eliminate deficits, Congress and the White House will have to identify $154 billion in savings in the year 2002. Last May, that number was $210 billion. President Clinton has taken the first step in the budget process, proposing $136 billion in Medicare savings over 6 years, a politically unpopular suggestion that was welcomed by Republicans as an olive branch, although there are differences between the two parties as to how those savings would be achieved. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
President Clinton may decide to delay his upcoming summit with Russian President Boris Yeltsin to accommodate the ailing Russian leader. The planning is still sketchy. More could be learned after Russian Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin visits Washington next week to meet with Vice President Al Gore. Yeltsin has just called off a trip to the Netherlands. He's apparently not recovered enough from his bout with double pneumonia. A tense calm has returned to the Japanese ambassador's residence in Lima, Peru, where 17 hostages remain held by rebels. Shots were fired yesterday at police guards surrounding the house. From Lima, John Miller reports.
The shots were fired as police SWAT teams paraded by the residents in armored vehicles, pointing their weapons and making obscene gestures at the rebels inside. Bullets ricocheted off one of the vehicles, but no one was injured. The police have set up a massive sound system near the compound and were playing military marches when the shooting occurred. A police helicopter was also circling overhead. Shortly after the shooting, the police withdrew to their normal positions. There was no unusual movement overnight. The show of force came just hours after the Prime Minister of Japan said he was worried that increased police activity was unsettling the hostages. Japan has been urging Peru to begin negotiating with the rebels, but the government and the rebels can't agree on an agenda. The Peruvian authorities say they're still committed to finding a peaceful solution to the crisis. For National Public Radio, I'm John Miller in Lima.
Mother Teresa will continue to head the Missionaries of Charity. A vote to elect her successor has been put off. No explanation for the delay was given by the Calcutta Archbishop. The 86-year-old Mother Teresa remains in frail health, confined to a wheelchair and on oxygen. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 91 points at 6,751. Trading is quite heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, Atlanta-based Home Depot will pay $245 million to buy the California-based Maintenance Warehouse America. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports.
According to a filing made with the Securities and Exchange Commission, if the deal falls through, Maintenance Warehouse will have to pay Home Depot $10 million. The price tag is more than twice the $100 million Wall Street analysts estimated when the deal for the San Diego mail order company was announced on January 16th. The filing says Maintenance Warehouse has a net income of $14 million, and Home Depot has an income of $130 million. Home Depot made its bid for Maintenance Warehouse when it was put up for auction in October 1996. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
A private business research group reports the nation's consumer confidence rose 2.6 points in January to a 7-year high of 116.8. It's the third consecutive monthly rise and a new sign of U.S. economic strength. And the government's employment cost index finds inflation is about what analysts were expecting. The Labor Department index of employment costs rose 0.8% in the fourth quarter of last year. The twin reports have relieved traders, particularly in the bond market. The bond market rose on the employment cost report and held gains, despite implications for higher spending and inflation in the consumer confidence numbers. Yields on 30-year Treasury bonds eased to 6.85% this morning from 6.94% late yesterday. The news has also pushed up the Dow. Again, it's up nearly 91 points at 6,751. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rebecca Adamson, was just chosen by Ms. Magazine as one of its Women of the Year for helping indigenous people claim their rights and preserve their wisdom. Adamson, who is part Cherokee, is the founder of the First Nations Development Institute, which provides about $1 million a year in grants and has a revolving loan fund of $1 million. She started the fund in 1980 after working several years in the movement to give Indians control over their schools. The goal of her institute is to help tribes become self-reliant by creating businesses and projects that will respond to their health, environmental, and spiritual needs. I asked her how she would compare her approach to the way banks and other conventional institutions make loans.
Well, we actually use a lot of the techniques that a bank uses. We'll use financing and lending and capital, just like a bank. But we really pay attention to values. And many times, working in the communities of Indian people, you're going to run into values that respect the environment, that hold the family unit as a priority, that look at reciprocity or sharing of the economic wealth in their family, so that in order for us to have successful economic development, we must pay a lot of attention to the values because they drive different goals. A business person on an Indian community is going to look at what his community needs by way of maybe a laundromat or a tire repair store, and then they may only want to grow so large. They don't want to have a huge store and franchise and become a Fortune 500 company.
Let's talk about one of the projects that you're funding, the Intertribal Bison Cooperative in South Dakota, and this has to do with raising buffalo. Tell us about the project.
Well, I think to start, one of the questions you just asked about a bank and how we're different than a bank would be summed up in this project. I don't think very many bank or loan officers would be lending to a buffalo project, but it's incredible in and of itself. I don't know if you've ever seen a buffalo up close, but they are magnificent. They weigh between a ton and a ton and a half. They're enormous animals. They're beautiful. They survive in weather that's anywhere from 70 to 100 degrees below zero. And in fact, I just got back from South Dakota yesterday, and the blizzards hit out there. And these buffalo are doing fine while the cattle are just dying. And the poor ranchers are facing probably economic depression for a while. But the buffalo are just going over the fence and roaming all over. Well, the buffalo is also held as very, very sacred to the Lakota people. The Buffalo Nation is seen as a model for the Lakota Nation. An intertribal bison co-op has dedicated itself since 1992 to restoring the buffalo herds among the Plains tribes. So the Plains tribes cover everything from Washington over to Michigan and from North Dakota down to Oklahoma. It's extensive prairie lands, and the herds are being reintroduced. Buffalo management is being taught. And agreements between the national parks and Indian nations are being forged through the Intertribal Bison Co-op.
Since the buffalo are considered sacred by many Native tribes, is it considered okay to actually eat buffalo meat?
It was viewed traditionally that the Buffalo Nation voluntarily gave their life to the Lakota Nation, that the buffalo consciously made a decision to give up their life for the food and feeding of the Lakota people. The thing that's interesting here, though, is that it's not just a commodity. The Native people view the buffalo in a way that's holistic. And it's even an asset aspect. It's a very economic, astute principle. They use all parts of the buffalo. The buffalo meat is four times the value on the market as cow meat. But that's because it's more nutritional. So that, yeah, the buffalo meat is just, it's delicious.
So is the Buffalo Project making money yet?
In some cases, the tribes are selling the buffalo meat. In some cases, the tribes have made a deliberate decision not to sell the buffalo meat. But if you look at it as far as a money-making thing, many of the families on these reservations probably have about an $8,000 a year income, and they're able to receive a calf by dedicating some of their land to the herd. So they get a calf that, as it grows, is going to be able to be sold for anywhere between $600 to $1,500. And every part of that buffalo gets sold. The hide gets sold, the horns get sold, the hooves get sold, the skull. Even the kneecaps have a market over in Asia for I don't know what, but there's a market there for buffalo kneecaps. And so if you look at a buffalo and they've raised it and they have four buffalo, they're getting anywhere between $2,400 to $6,000 a year, which is 30% or 75% of their annual income.
Rebecca Adamson is my guest, and she's the founder of First Nations Development Institute, which makes grants and loans to Native American groups. Let's look at another project that you're funding, and this has to do with the Hopi Indians. Tell us about this.
Well, the Hopis have a saying called Yitam Nyap Yani, which means we're responsible for our destiny. And they're a fascinating, very, very traditional community. There's about 12 villages there. And they don't want any kind of wires crossing their land. And they've come up with a solar energy project. They've been very suspicious of these kinds of newfangled programs that come into the pueblos. So they've held off from electricity all these years. And now they're looking at solar energy.
So is this a way of uniting the past and the present in Hopi tradition?
Oh, very much so. A lot of times what you see come out of some of the projects that we're involved with, they'll say pursuing tradition with a business sense and business with a sense of tradition. And what we have within the Hopi project is really looking at very traditional values, a sacredness of the land, and taking that value and translating it into an extremely modern contemporary project, which is a solar energy project, which right now has been installed in over 300 homes. Economically, it also reduces the utility rate because once you've paid for the solar system, you no longer have any kind of utility bills. But the real purpose here, Terry, was the culture and the respect for the land and the fact that the Hopi people very much want to be self-sufficient and didn't want to be dependent on an outside source of energy.
Since you're dealing with what you describe as culturally appropriate development, I wonder what you think of the movement toward casinos on reservations.
What we've seen with the casinos is the first thing that has to be understood is it's a sovereign right of a tribe. It's not a special advantage or a special exception, but very much a sovereign right based upon our treaties. They provide, in some cases, a wonderful opportunity for making a profit. Not all tribes that do gaming, there's about 100, and not all of them are really, really profitable. There's only like about 10% that are making a lot of money. And what we see happening is the basic question of why do you want to be rich gets asked. And when the tribe answers that in a traditional sense, they look at answering it from a point of being self-sufficient and providing opportunities for their people. We've seen tribes like the Oneida tribes in Wisconsin have a socially responsible investment program. We've also seen cases, though, where someone comes in and wants to do a get-rich-quick scheme, and then it really does disrupt the culture. So it varies. Some of it's been very good, and in cases where it's not been done well, it's had disastrous results.
Do you think a lot of it has to do with what the goals are and how you plan on using the money?
Oh, exactly. It was funny. We worked with a tribe in Michigan around a $16 million investment program, and they had set as a goal the long-range economic and social well-being of their people. Another tribe, several states over, had set a goal as making the most profit. Ironically, the tribe did make the most profit in their state, but they had the highest teenage suicide rate. Hmm. And I don't think that's a coincidence. On the other hand, you had a tribe that was very deliberate looking at how to take those earnings and bring them back into the community in a way that was about culture and a way that was about values.
Would you ever fund a casino project?
Well, we wouldn't, because you can always get financing for it somewhere else.
Good point.
There's a lot of people out there that would look at that. But what we would look at is the investment strategies behind a casino operation. And we have done a number of those, and we've seen more and more tribes both looking at investment strategies and looking at grant making and philanthropy within their profits. A number of these tribes are giving money away to very, very good causes, such as women's abuse centers, such as environmental programs, such as low-income housing. So they're becoming the up-and-coming sort of new philanthropists in the United States.
You've become a philanthropist yourself, giving money for projects in Native American reservations. Is it hard for you to say no? I mean, you were really in this for altruistic reasons. You want to help people spiritually and culturally, economically. But you can't give money to everybody. You have to be very hard-headed, I'm sure, when you're evaluating the spiritual and financial thinking behind a project, which means saying no a lot. Is that hard?
Well, yes and no. In one sense, if we're looking at what we're trying to accomplish, it's about self-sufficiency. And so these projects absolutely have to be doable. And you're not helping if you're just setting people up for failure. We have had numbers of failures. We have a legacy of failure out there that's been brought about by federal government programs where Congress gets together with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and decides we should do motels 1 year, industrial parks another year. They never, ever worked because they never built upon who we were and our own problem solving. Even though we're very non-prescriptive in what we would fund, we look at the actual financial and the capacity, the doability of these projects with very sharp eyes.
My guest is Rebecca Adamson, founding president of the First Nations Development Institute. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Rebecca Adamson. She's the founder of First Nations Development Institute, which makes culturally appropriate loans and grants to Native American projects. You're half Cherokee, yes?
A quarter.
Quarter.
Yeah.
Did you grow up with Native culture?
I did. I grew up, my father was Swedish and my mom was Cherokee. So I grew up in a mixed house. I think my dad was also first generation Swedish, so it was very much some of the Swedish foods and some of the Swedish cultures there. And then I would spend my summers with my grandparents in North Carolina, where it was just really predominantly Cherokee in culture and very, very rural. So I had really the best of both worlds.
How did you first get involved in the Native rights movement?
Well, I think while I had the best of both worlds, growing up it was actually a struggle trying to understand that there was a difference in the two worlds and what that difference was so that I could become comfortable, well, actually comfortable within myself. And I began hitchhiking a lot. And I noticed that when I would go home and when I'd go back out to visit my other relatives, that just, for instance, the school systems were so different. We had a wonderful public school where I grew up in Ohio. And when I'd go down to North Carolina or when I was out west in South Dakota or in Montana or Oklahoma and I'd go to Indian schools out there, I was horrified by the conditions. There was a teacher in Oklahoma that just practiced taping that white surgical tape across every Indian kid's mouth. They would come in the morning, she'd tape their mouth shut, they could take the tape off for lunch, and then they had to put it back on for the rest of the day. That's the kind of schools that Indian kids were going to, and we're talking about in the 1970s, Terry. It didn't take a real lot for me to discover that I wanted to be a part of changing that. It was a very visceral kind of, this is not right. There is no way this country can excuse the kind of schools that and the treatment that the Indian kids were getting in those schools in those days.
When you started First Nations, which gives grants and loans to Native Americans, did you know anything about money?
No, I didn't. And I didn't have any desire to know anything about money. Actually, I majored in philosophy, and it was a crack up to see me sitting down there doing cash flow projections and financial analysis. But while I backed into it very naturally, because once I understood what was happening, it became extremely important for me to understand financial workings. And so while in one sense I still get a kick out of some of the things I do, like I'm on a mutual fund, the Calvert Social Investment Fund, I'm on their board of directors, and it cracks me up that I'm looking at basis points and securities portfolios and the number of things I've gotten involved in, it's pointed more and more to the fact that we have to understand the financial markets, because right now they are driving us instead of us using them to better our lives. Many towns and people are having to respond to what the financial market says, and the financial market says they're going to lose their job this year. We have to bring these things back under control and connect them to community. And you see that kind of work happening just in the example you gave before. The gaming tribes are doing some very interesting work on how they use their money to build community. And we need to look at the financial markets we created and how we're going to get back to building community.
Were there any insecurities that you had to overcome to get the confidence that you could actually deal with money and understand financial futures?
Oh, very much so. I think on a personal level, I did grow up in a different culture. And just, for example, within an Indian culture, in my culture in particular, you would always have a very gentle handshake out of respect for the other person. And you would never look them directly in the eye, again, out of respect for the relationship. It's seen as very invasive. And you don't ask direct questions, which I don't know what would happen to your job. But that was sort of the understanding. So for me, working like in a New York foundation going in, I had to practice in my head over and over. I'd say, look them straight in the eye and do a firm handshake. And then I'd be sitting there thinking, oh, my God, I'm not listening to what they say. And if they asked me a question, I'm dead, because I was so busy remembering to look them in the eye, you know, that I wasn't listening to what they were saying. So it was hard. It was actually hard in the beginning. And it also taught me, though, more about cultural respect, in that looking in the eye is showing interest, direct questions are interests, you know, just the different interpretation of very similar behavior. And I learned to be that interpreter, and in some ways that's still what First Nations is. We just translate and interpret the cultures.
I wonder if you think that your goal is in part to help Natives find ways of living in the present while being connected to the past.
Very much so. And I think it goes both ways. I think that we feel that in one sense, the concept ancient futures, some of the things that we have accomplished as a people, socially, economically, and politically, are lessons that could carry us forward today. And I say that because using my own tribe, we really believe in both the women and men being equal. And we had a white council that was the women's council that ruled during the times of peace, and a red council that was the men's council that ruled during war.
Traditionally in the past?
Traditionally in the past, until the Bureau of Indian Affairs came in. But the focus was on balance, Terry. We understood that we needed a balance within our society, that what was rich about the people was the different ways of making decisions. So we organized to have a balance in the different approaches to decision-making. Another one is we really cared for kids. Our kids were our future. And so you could marry a Cherokee woman, which was fine, and you could divorce a Cherokee woman, which was fine. But the property stayed with the kids, which is so different than today, where the kids are almost property in the courts today. It's just not the way we looked at things. And I think that that kind of heritage is one that will give us solutions for where we're going today, because we're way off course. I say that Indian people are sort of the miner's canary in a development process that's gone haywire. And, you know, those are those little birds that they took down into the mines, and if poisonous gases escaped, the canary died. But then everybody in the mine was in trouble. And the things that are happening and have happened on reservations are happening in inner cities now. They're happening in rural America. They're happening on our borders. They're happening in developing worlds. We truly have to come to grips with what we're doing for the sake of economic development.
I'm just going to ask you a word question. You use the word Indian a lot. Are you comfortable with that word?
I am. I think to be politically correct, you would refer to me as a Cherokee person. You would use the tribe that I'm from because that's truly the nation I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the argument that if not the actual tribe, then you would use Native American. But, you know, we've been called Indians for 500 years, and most of us are really comfortable with it.
You have also consulted with Native peoples in other countries. And maybe you could tell us about one of those issues that you've worked on and the impact that it had on you.
Well, I think the lessons that we've learned in First Nations around culturally appropriate development are in demand throughout the world by Indigenous people. And if you look at our issues everywhere, you're going to look at land, self-governance, and culture as our key issues. And we're getting more and more requests from around the world in countries I've never even heard of to come and talk. Well, you can't just come and talk. We went over to Botswana, which is just north of South Africa, and the government had decided to forcibly remove the last of the Bushmen from their ancestral territories, which was the central Kalahari Desert. We've begun working with them because it's just not right. The people who have lived for 60,000 years in this territory are now going to be moved off for cattle. And we've launched a very aggressive program to try to work with the government to stop the removal and to look with the Bushmen and the Kwai leaders in understanding their rights and looking at development opportunities once they've secured their territories.
It must have been interesting for you to meet Bushmen.
Oh, they're incredible. You know, they have perhaps the oldest language known to mankind, and when they talk, you can hear the sound of wind under a bird's wing when it takes off, or the noise of the grass rustling when an animal comes through it. And that's the language. That you hear that in the language. It's just incredible. These people are so beautiful.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you a lot.
Rebecca Adamson is the president of the First Nations Development Institute in Fredericksburg, Virginia. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the winners, the losers, and the in-between. We talk with John Powers about his experiences as a juror at the Sundance Film Festival. Also, Maureen Carrigan tells us about the return of a 50-year-old novel by the Nobel Prize-winning author from Iceland, Haldur Laxness. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's probably every independent filmmaker's dream to win the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. The festival, which was created by Robert Redford and is held in Park City, Utah, is the most important showcase for independents. The distribution deals made there determine which independent films will end up seeing in movie theaters. At this year's festival, there was a lot riding on the judgment of our film critic John Powers, who served on the festival jury for dramatic films. This year's award ceremony was Saturday night at the conclusion of the festival. We asked John, who's also film critic for Vogue magazine, to tell us about some of the films he watched at the festival and what it was like to be a juror. He says the festival this year was low-key compared to the apotheosis of commercialism and star-studdedness it reached last year.
Well, I think the thing that happened last year was probably a confluence of all sorts of things. The sort of hipness quotient of Sundance had been rising for years. There were a lot of films last year which were very commercial and good films, like I Shot Andy Warhol, Big Night, even like films that weren't talked about much at Sundance last year, like Citizen Ruth, later got commercial release. So there was a real sense that this was the place where reputations were made and where young Hollywood would come to find out what was going on. And then what happened, I think, either through some design of the festival organizers in an attempt to decommercialize it, or just through the happenstance of history, that didn't happen this year. And almost every film was small, it didn't have stars, it wasn't particularly commercial. I would say that only two or three of the films that were in the competition this year will actually get commercial release.
Well, that's not many at all.
It's not many. There were 18 films in the competition. And what was striking was a lot of them were sort of small, nice, well-made films of a kind that probably most audiences wouldn't find very exciting. The winning film was a film called Sunday, and it's a good example. It's a very lovely film about a middle-aged man who's lost his job and is now living in a sort of a shelter for men, who gets involved with a fading English actress who lives in Queens. And it simply follows them on their day, which is a Sunday, and it's about their lives. It's beautifully shot, beautifully acted. The director, Jonathan Nossiter, is the kind of person who Sundance used to exist to serve. He made a film probably thinking this will never get distribution, this will never win an award. And when he actually won the Grand Jury Prize for Best Film, he looked as if he'd been hit with a stun gun. I mean, his face was white with delight. I mean, I think he simply couldn't believe that he had won the festival with this film that in so many ways seemed so resolutely uncommercial. And it's a very good film, I would add, that the jury had no trouble selecting it as the best film, and that all the critics I've talked to who saw the film all think it's a good film. But there was so little buzz surrounding it that when the award was announced on the Saturday night ceremony, there was a kind of strange silence in the hall because the people who'd gone to films because of their buzz and their hipness hadn't seen it. So suddenly that the winning film was a film that only a few people had seen, but the people who'd seen it all thought it was a very good film.
Is this a film you'd go out of your way to see?
This actually is a film I'd go out of my way to see. I can tell you that when I read the description in the Sundance catalog before going, I thought, oh my God, this is going to be grim. This is a film I really don't want to see. You know, I mean, who wants to see the stories about the illusions of middle-aged people? You know, I mean, I have my own illusions. I'm already middle-aged. I don't need it. And in fact, when I saw the film, it's funny, it's sad, it's consistently surprising, it's beautifully written. David Suchet, or maybe it's Suchet, and Lisa Harrow acted wonderfully. It held me all the way through, and everyone I knew felt the same way.
So, John, this is your first time on the jury at Sundance. What does it mean to be a juror? What's your job?
Well, there are several competition categories. You know, there's dramatic and documentary, for instance. I was on the dramatic jury, and what that actually means is that I see 18 films along with four other people, and then we try to decide which one is, you know, the best film, which one has the best direction, and so forth. In practice, what it means is two things. On the nice side, it means that you have a little badge that means you automatically get a good seat at every show. And at Sundance, that's an important thing because you're often, if you don't have such a badge, standing outside in the snow or the cold waiting to try to get in to see a film. The second thing that it means is that you are treated as being somehow more charming than you've ever been before. You know, that I went from being what I am, I became instantly more sexually attractive simply because I was wearing a juror badge, which I must say is not a thing I mind. At the same time, you know, there's a downside, which is you have to see 18 films, several of which are not very good, and you have to sit all the way through them, because even if you sort of run off to the men's room at some point, there's the risk of causing a scandal, because the filmmaker will say, oh, the person didn't see my whole film. So that you are very visible, and you're watching films, as I say, a lot of them not very good, and trying to be completely expressionless. So I spent an entire week or 10 days with, for me, the agonizing situation of not being able to talk about what I've seen.
Could you talk about it with the other jurors?
I could talk about it with the other jurors, but because we were on a different schedule, because we were seeing public screenings, I sometimes wouldn't see one for 2 or 3 days. And because I've sort of been on the film festival and film critic circuit for so long, I know scads of people. So probably 30 or 40 or 50 times a day, people would ask me what I thought about something. And every time I'd have to say, I can't talk. And that is agony. Especially because after you've seen maybe 5 films in a day and only one of them was half decent, your head is exploding. It's like something like in a David Cronenberg movie where the lava just wants to shoot out of your skull. And yet you just have to sort of smile wryly and listen to them talk. Well, actually, one of the cool things about that, though, is you discover how insecure people are because you say, I can't say what I thought of the film, but what do you think? And you watch them talk, and when your face has no expression, you watch people melt down as they begin telling their opinion because they can't tell what you think of what they're saying. And so it's actually psychologically interesting that even people who seem kind of tough and hardened critics, after talking for a minute to someone who's not responding at all, they start looking like anchor people on the news when the camera's held on them too long.
What other notable films did you see at Sundance? I know that David Lynch had a new film screen there, Lost Highway. What'd you think of it? Did you get to see it?
Well, actually, I had seen Lost Highway before.
Oh.
And I think it's simultaneously brilliant and disappointing. David Lynch is one of the few people in the world who I think is unfailingly interesting. And yet there's a way in which this film seems to be sort of covering some old ground. So there are, the film has within it perhaps the most interesting sex scene in a movie in the last 3 or 4 years. I mean, it's actually one of the rare sex scenes that doesn't make me yawn. And at the same time, there are parts of it that seem just like the usual David Lynch thing. A film that I particularly liked that wasn't in competition that will be coming out, later this spring is a thing called Chasing Amy by Kevin Smith, the young man who made a film called Clerks a couple of years ago. And it's a really interesting and wonderful film about a cartoon or a comic book artist who falls in love with a lesbian and what ensues from that. And I mean, I'm sure I'll be reviewing it on this show when it comes out, so I don't want to give away too much. But what struck me about it was that it was the film that if I were a father of a teenage son, I would most want the son to see.
Hmm.
Because it's actually about how a kind of overgrown boy falls in love with a woman and her behavior changes his perceptions of himself, what it means to love, and how you respect other people's autonomy. And so it's filled with sort of all sorts of really sort of hilarious and scabrous jokes of a kind that might put lots of people off. Yet the essential values of the film are incredibly warm, humane, sophisticated. And I think in lots of ways, a lot of the kind of cheap sexual jokes that might lead some adults to kind of wince a bit are precisely the things I think that would draw teenagers in. Because the film sort of speaks their language, and then just as it's speaking their language, says, yes, but there's something a little bit wrong with your language. Your language actually could be more subtle. It could actually, that really, should you really be making fun of the high school slut? Maybe she was actually doing something in her life that was as valid in her life as what you're doing.
There's a movie I've read a little bit about with a very intriguing title called Bob Flanagan, Masochist. Did you see it?
Yes, it's it's actually kind of an extraordinary and excruciating film, because Bob Flanagan was a man who I believe he had cystic fibrosis, and as the film's being made, he's dying of his disease, and as his way of making sense of his life and his pain, he became a performance artist masochist to reclaim his pain and basically initiate his own pain on himself as his way of asserting control over his life. So the film is bloody, and it contains things like Bob driving a nail into his penis, which I guess is not something that most people either want to see or do. And yet the film has a kind of strange, extraordinary power because it actually is about mortal things and about the fact that we all have bodies. And this guy is doing such extreme things with his bodies that it turns out to be a kind of strangely spiritual film, if that makes any sense, that it's about what happens when your body is betraying you so completely that you have to define who you are using that betraying body, but independent of it at the same time.
My guest is our film critic, John Powers. We're talking about the Sundance Film Festival. He served as a juror. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our film critic, John Powers. We're talking about his experiences as a juror at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The award ceremony was Saturday night. Is there a kind of film you are really tired of now and hope to never see again?
Well, actually, there are so many films that I'm tired of and hope to never see again. I think I don't ever need to see another alienated teenager as long as I live. You know, and what's actually funny about a festival like this is that Patrick Duncan, a fellow juror, and I, you know, we're obsessed with the amount of vomiting in the films. One of the great themes of this year's competition was the sequence where someone vomited. Of the 18 competition films, 11 contained that sequence. And I think I never need to see another person throw up on camera again. I guess that probably the vomit sequences are probably some sort of show of integrity. You know, we're really getting to the nitty-gritty of life. But by now, they're as cliched as the kind of love montage, you know, with a pop song playing in the background that you see in a Hollywood movie.
What else would you hope to never see again?
I think I never want to see another young man discover that he's gay or a young woman discover that she's lesbian, simply because Sundance has now produced so many of those that I don't mind if young men and women discover that they're gay or lesbian, but I don't want that to be the story. I mean, I have the feeling that they're reinventing the wheel now in a certain kind of way over and over again. I mean, as I say, that we've gotten it. You know, it's in film terms and in human terms, it now is, it's not so surprising. So there's a certain kind of way with stories like that, a certain kind of coming out story or coming of age story. I'm also tired of films in which sort of young heterosexual white men learn what it's like to have sex for the first time.
Or I was just thinking about how frustrating it must be for you in some ways. So on the one hand, really philosophically and intellectually want to champion independent film, and to, on the other hand, often get kind of, you know, bored with it.
Yes, well, I think the great independent film crisis is that that just because you're independent doesn't mean your film is good, in the same kind of way that just because you made a film in Hollywood doesn't make your film bad. And that I personally have always kind of liked some of the sides of Sundance that other people find corrupt. Because I think there's a way in which film is often better if people's baser instincts are linked to their better instincts. that I think if you simply are just trying to make a film simply because you love it, often the film that emerges is either self-indulgent or a little dull. Whereas if you're making a film that you really believe in because you love it, and at the same time you want the whole world to see it and maybe become famous because of it, there's a certain vitality or edge that comes to the films that you don't often get with the films that simply are trying to be well-meaning. I mean, in the old days, Sundance used to be, you know, this kind of hideously granolid festival where every film was about somebody coming of age on a farm in Indiana. You know, and they all had titles like Stacking, you know, referring to wheat stacking, or Season of Dreams. You know, and you just go there and you think, this is what people are making? You know, they all want to tell this one story. And you couldn't imagine why anyone in the world would want to see those films. But as independent film took off a little bit and you actually began getting slightly more glamorous and some might say corrupt figures like, you know, Quentin Tarantino involved, there was a certain vitality or zing that came into the filmmaking. And people realized it's possible to do something that expresses a personal vision while at the same time being fun to watch. A lot of the films in this year's festival weren't as much fun to watch as I would have liked. And, you know, when you see 18 all the way through, you will be, you know, you're really struck by the number of films that don't quite work simply at the simplest level of entertainment.
What do you think Sundance does at its best and its worst?
At its best, what Sundance does is it allows people who make films that don't fit into any familiar category to be seen, perhaps to be discovered, and perhaps change the entire way that American film culture works. So that if you take certain filmmakers, you know, and you could even, and Quentin Tarantino might be the most obvious example, and in some ways, he's an example of the worst as well, is that without someplace like Sundance, a film like Reservoir Dogs might never have been noticed in the kind of way that it was. It made his reputation, it made it possible for him to make Pulp Fiction, and there's a certain kind of vitality that he brought to movies that you might not have had if there hadn't been a showcase like Sundance that would actually give a high profile to a film like that, or to Sex, Lies, and Videotape, or to certain Spike Lee films, or films like Clerks, that a lot of the great forces in filmmaking come from the margins rather than the center of the culture. And the margins are very well represented at Sundance. And what's interesting, and maybe this is the pernicious side, is the way that Hollywood has gotten very, very good at buying up whatever is fresh and new that comes from the margins. You know, there was a time when you could be avant-garde and maybe stay on the margins for, you know, 10 or 20 years, or at least be even slightly adventurous and stay on the margins for 10 or 20 years. Now, if it seems to work, there's so much competition in the larger film industry and the successful film industry to find new blood that you can be taken up and devoured before you even know what's hit you. So, you know, so there are lots of young filmmakers who come with a fresh vision that's not quite developed. The film gets admired at Sundance, and within a couple of years, they're making a Hollywood studio film that isn't nearly as interesting as what they might have made if they hadn't made it, if they hadn't made it at Sundance. On the other hand, if they hadn't made it at Sundance, they might not have made another film at all, because they would be struggling to get money. You know, they'd be talking to their dentist, actually trying to get a, you know, $5,000 investment. So that it's a very complicated thing. The mixture of sort of Hollywood and independence is the most vexed issue at Sundance, and it covers everything from the city of Park City, where the festival is held, you know, which is a weird mixture of, you know, ludicrous sort of tourist stores with names like The Shirt Farm, to restaurants so egregiously expensive that even people who live in L.A. and New York gasp at the price of the spinach lasagna. Okay, and then that's the town. Then you have the man who runs nominally in charge of the festival, Robert Redford, who simultaneously wants to make this an independent showcase, but whose own last film was Up Close and Personal with Michelle Pfeiffer. And then you have the competition films where, you know, you actually have, you know, Tori Spelling is in one of the competition films. So she's both Hollywood, yet the film is a very independent film made on a very low budget. And that split between the commercial and the independent is the very essence of the thing. And some years what happens is it seems to split and fall apart. You know, like as if, let's say, you've taken a cake and chopped it and both sides fell apart. And at other times, the split seems to have some sort of spark of special creativity. And Sundance, at its best, actually gives you that spark of creativity that comes from having two very different things in sort of opposition to one another.
Shine was first screened at Sundance last year. I guess it was last year. And that went on to become a really big commercial art house success. So is everybody looking for the new Shine now? Well, the distributors looking to pounce on the new Shine?
Yes, they actually are. In fact, the new Shine will be one of those concepts that we'll be hearing at Sundance for the next few years, because everyone was looking for the new Shine. It was kind of funny. Anytime a film was from Australia, because Shine is Australian, people would line up to see it, thinking it might be the new Shine. There's a film called Black Rock, which was being highly touted as the new Shine, except the difference was that it was about Australian louts, and it's an incredibly loud movie. And, you know, almost precisely the opposite tone, subject matter, and style of Shine. Yet because it was from Australia, people kept thinking, this could be the new Shine.
How much does Robert Redford show up for? It is, after all, the festival that he initiated in his town.
Robert Redford often shows up in the evenings at his restaurant in town called Zoom, but in relation to the festival as a whole, he tends to appear only at the filmmaker's brunch, which is held on the opening Saturday, and then on awards night, where he usually gives a slightly earnest and dull speech saying that the festival belongs to the filmmakers. This year he didn't show up for that because he was trapped by snowfall and an avalanche up at his place in up at Sundance. So he didn't show up there. I think he is increasingly shy about doing it, and so that, rather like God, he's more present in his effects than in his visibility. But there's a great, you know, myth that surrounds Redford at Sundance, because whenever anything changes at all at the festival, everyone always wonders whether Bob, as everyone refers to him there, whether Bob did it. And, you know, one of the kind of funny sidebars of this is listening to press people and industry people saying, I wonder what Bob thought about this. Are the films not commercial this year because Bob told them to not have commercial films? You know, I heard that Bob was unhappy that so many films were violent back in 1994. And, you know, so like Bob becomes, you know, Godot or something. It's actually kind of a funny thing, but I think that's because everybody wants Bob to be in charge. Yet my general sense of it is that in sort of a general conceptual way, he has input, but that the festival director, Jeff Gilmore, has far more say over which films are in. I mean, I think probably I would be surprised if Robert Redford saw five of the films in the festival.
Well, John, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, I'm always happy to do it. You know that.
John Powers is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for Vogue magazine. Coming up, a novel is rescued from obscurity. This is Fresh Air. Icelandic author Haldur Laxness won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1955, in part for his novel Independent People, which was first published in 1946. For decades, though, the novel has been out of print in English, and Laxness's work has been known only to a few enthusiasts. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that a new reprint of Independent People is changing that situation.
A review copy of Independent People, a reprint of a 50-plus-year-old novel by Icelandic author Haldur Laxness, arrived on my doorstep a few weeks ago, emblazoned with dazzling cover blurbs. One of the best books of the 20th century, declares Jane Smiley. One of my top 10 favorite books of all time, exclaims E. Annie Prue. Clearly, this new paperback edition of Independent People, translated from the Icelandic by J.A. Thompson, represents a kind of literary 911 call designed to resuscitate the work of a great writer whose reputation in this country is close to expiring. Independent People was originally subtitled An Epic. Maybe Laxness's current publishers felt that daunting generic label would scare off readers, for they omitted it from this reprint. But Independent People is an epic story, and how. It chronicles the long life of a sheep farmer named Beater, who, in the first decades of this century, has freed himself from 18 years of indentured servitude to the local bailiff. Beater settles in a turf cottage in a desolate valley that for centuries has been regarded by the local people as cursed. But stubborn Beater refuses to bow before demons or landlords. Season after season, he tends his flock, steeling himself against sorrows like the deaths of his two wives and numerous children at birth, a son's abrupt emigration to America, and a daughter's out-of-wedlock pregnancy. In the opening pages of the novel, a bemused third-person narrator tells us what makes Beater and his neighbors tick. They were peasants, sheepmen, who toiled like slaves over their flocks the whole year round, till they died without ever having transacted a business deal involving more than a few dollars at a time. Independence was their great capital. I fear I'm making Independent People sound like a glacial companion piece to Pearl S. Buck's The Good Earth. It's a much more morally complicated and quirkier tale. While the novel respects Beater's stick-to-itiveness, It also regards his monomaniacal focus on sheep as, well, stupid. This is an agrarian epic that illuminates what Marx called the idiocy of rural life. Subsisting on salt codfish and coffee, Beater and his family work 16-hour days in summer, scything meadows until their rubbery muscles beat the wet grass in endless imbecility. An Icelandic variation of the kind of deadpan Nordic response to horror that made the movie Fargo such an offbeat hoot also infuses the world of independent people. In a thrilling episode, one of many that fill the novel, Beater hunts a reindeer, only to shortly find himself clinging to its back as man and beast are swept down a freezing river. Beater finally manages to leap onto an ice slab, and after rolling around in the snow to warm his wet, numb body, he crawls on all fours through a blizzard for 2 days until he reaches a cottage. His reflection on the whole episode? Well, Beater says to himself, at least you're getting about a bit these days, my lad. Beater's relationship with his beloved daughter, Soli, is at the heart of independent people. It's a father-daughter bond so tortured and inarticulate that some scenes between them are almost unbearable to read. For years, the two are estranged, seeming to fulfill the narrator's early prediction that time effaces everything, crime and sorrow no less than love. Time also threatened to efface the reputation of Haldor Laxness and his magnificent novel. Thanks to this new reprint, though, that process has been reversed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Tracy Tannenbaum, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of The Moral Intelligence of Children, How to Raise a Moral Child by Robert Coles. This is NPR, National Public Radio.